When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 7 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in January 2008. Chapter 7. Premonition. Marguerite neither moved nor spoke. She felt two pairs of eyes fixed upon her, and with all the strength of will at her command she forced the very blood in her veins not to quit her cheeks, forced her eyelids not to betray by a single quiver the icy pang of a deadly premonition which at sight of Chauvelin seemed to have chilled her entire soul. There he stood before her, dressed in his usual sombre garments, a look almost of humility in those keen grey eyes of his, which a year ago, on the cliffs of Calais, had peered down at her with such relentless hate. Strange that at this moment she should have felt an instinct of fear. What cause had she to throw more than a pitiful glance at the man who had tried so cruelly to wrong her, and who had so signally failed? Having bowed very low and very respectfully, Chauvelin advanced towards her, with all the airs of a disgraced courtier craving audience from his queen. As he approached, she instinctively drew back. "Would you prefer not to speak to me, Lady Blakeney?" he said humbly. She could scarcely believe her ears or trust her eyes. It seemed impossible that a man could have so changed in a few months. He looked even shorter than last year, more shrunken within himself. His hair, which he wore free from powder, was perceptibly tinged with grey. "Shall I withdraw?" he added after a pause, seeing that Marguerite made no movement to return his salutation. "It would be best, perhaps," she replied coldly. "You and I, Monsieur Chauvelin, have so little to say to one another." "Very little indeed," he rejoined quietly. "The triumphant and happy have ever very little to say to the humiliated and the defeated. But I had hoped that Lady Blakeney, in the midst of her victory, would have spared one thought of pity and one of pardon." "I did not know that you had need of either from me, monsieur." "Pity, perhaps not, but forgiveness, certainly." "You have that, if you so desire it." "Since I failed, you might try to forget." "That is beyond my power, but believe me, I have ceased to think of the infinite wrong which you try to do to me." "But I failed," he insisted, "and I meant no harm to you." "To those I care for, Monsieur Chauvelin." "I had to serve my country as best I could. I meant no harm to your brother. He is safe in England now, and the Scarlet Pimpernel was nothing to you." She tried to read his face, tried to discover in those inscrutable eyes of his some hidden meaning to his words. Instinct had warned her, of course, that this man could be nothing but an enemy, always and at all times. But he seemed so broken, so abject now, that contempt for his dejected attitude and for the defeat which had been inflicted on him chased the last remnant of fear from her heart. "I did not even succeed in harming that enigmatical personage," continued Chauvelin with the same self-abasement. "Sir Percy Blakeney, you remember, threw himself across my plans, quite innocently, of course. I failed where you succeeded. Luck has deserted me. Our government offered me a humble post away from France. I look after the interests of French subjects settled in England. My days of power are over. My failure is complete. I do not complain, for I failed in a combat of wits. But I failed. I failed. I failed. I am almost a fugitive, and I am quite disgraced. That is my present history, Lady Blakeney," he concluded, taking once more a step towards her. "And you will understand that it would be a solace if you extended your hand to me just once more, and let me feel that, although you would never willingly look upon my face again, you have enough womanly tenderness in you to force your heart to forgiveness and, mayhap, to pity." Marguerite hesitated. He held out his hand, and her warm, impulsive nature prompted her to be kind. but instinct would not be gainsaid, a curious instinct to which she refused to respond. What had she to fear from this miserable and cringing little worm, who had not even in him the pride of defeat? What harm could he do to her, or to those whom she loved? Her brother was in England. Her husband? Bah! Not the enmity of the entire world could make her fear for him. Nay, that instinct, which caused her to draw away from Chauvelin as she would from a venomous asp, was certainly not fear. It was hate. She hated this man, hated him for all that she had suffered because of him, for that terrible night on the cliffs of Calais, the peril to her husband who had become so infinitely dear, the humiliations and self-reproaches which he had endured. Yes, it was hate, and hate was of all emotions the one she most despised. Hate! Does one hate a slimy but harmless toad or a stinging fly? It seemed ridiculous, contemptible and pitiable to think of hate in connection with the melancholy figure of this discomfited intriguer, this fallen leader of revolutionary France. He was holding out his hand to her. If she placed even the tips of her fingers upon it, she would be making the compact of mercy and forgiveness which he was asking of her. The woman, Desiree Candeille, roused within her the last lingering vestige of her slumbering wrath. False, theatrical and stagey, as Marguerite had originally suspected, she appeared to have been in league with Chauvelin to bring about this undesirable meeting. Lady Blakeney turned from one to another, trying to conceal her contempt beneath a mask of passionless indifference. Candeille was standing close by, looking obviously distressed and not a little puzzled. An instant's reflection was sufficient to convince Marguerite that the whilom actress of the Varieté Theatre was obviously ignorant of the events to which Chauvelin had been alluding. She was, therefore, of no serious consequence, a mere tool, mayhap, in the ex-ambassador's hands. At the present moment she looked like a silly child who does not understand the conversation of the grown-ups. Marguerite had promised her help and protection, had invited her to her house, and offered her a munificent gift in aid of a deserving cause. She was too proud to go back now on that promise, to rescind the contract because of an unexplainable fear. With regard to Chauvelin, the matter stood differently. She had made him no direct offer of hospitality. She had agreed to receive in her house the official chaperone of an unprotected girl, but she was not called upon to show cordiality to her own and her husband's most deadly enemy. She was ready to dismiss him out of her life with a cursory word of pardon and a half-expressed promise of oblivion. On that understanding, and that only, she was ready to let her hand rest for the space of 1 second in his. She had looked upon her fallen enemy, seen his discomfiture and his humiliation. Very well. Now let him pass out of her life all the more easily, since the last vision of him would be one of such utter abjection as would be even unworthy of hate. All these thoughts, feelings, and struggles passed through her mind with great rapidity. Her hesitation had lasted less than 5 seconds. Chauvelin still wore the look of doubting entreaty with which he had first begged permission to take her hand in his. With an impulsive toss of the head, she had turned straight towards him, ready with the phrase with which she meant to dismiss him from her sight now and forever, when suddenly a well-known laugh broke in upon her ear, and a lazy, drawly voice said pleasantly, "La, I vow the air is fit to poison you. Your Royal Highness, I entreat, let us turn our backs upon these gates of Inferno, where lost souls would feel more at home than doth your humble servant." The next moment His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales had entered the tent, closely followed by Sir Percy Blakeney. End of chapter 7. Chapter 8 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in January 2008. Chapter 8. The Invitation. It was in truth a strange situation, this chance meeting between Percy Blakeney and ex-ambassador Chauvelin. Marguerite looked up at her husband. She saw him shrug his broad shoulders as he first caught sight of Chauvelin, and glance down in his usual lazy, good-humoured manner at the shrunken figure of the silent Frenchman. The words she meant to say never crossed her lips. She was waiting to hear what the two men would say to one another. The instinct of the grande dame in her, the fashionable lady accustomed to the exigencies of society, just gave her sufficient presence of mind to make the requisite low curtsey before His Royal Highness. But the prince, forgetting his accustomed gallantry, was also absorbed in the little scene before him. He, too, was looking from the sable-clad figure of Chauvelin to that of gorgeously arrayed Sir Percy. He, too, like Marguerite, was wondering what was passing behind the low, smooth forehead of that inimitable dandy, what behind the inscrutably good-humoured expression of those sleepy eyes. Of the five persons thus present in the dark and stuffy booth, certainly Sir Percy Blakeney seemed the least perturbed. He had paused just long enough to allow Chauvelin to become fully conscious of a feeling of supreme irritation and annoyance, then he strolled up to the ex-ambassador with hand outstretched and the most engaging of smiles. "Ah," he said, with his usual half-shy, half-pleasant, tempered smile, "my engaging friend from France. I hope, sir, that our demmed climate doth find you well and hearty today." The cheerful voice seemed to ease the tension. Marguerite sighed a sigh of relief. After all, what was more natural than that Percy, with his amazing fund of pleasant irresponsibility, should thus greet the man who had once vowed to bring him to the guillotine? Chauvelin himself, accustomed by now to the audacious coolness of his enemy, was scarcely taken by surprise. He bowed low to His Highness, who, vastly amused at Blakeney's sally, was inclined to be gracious to everyone, even though the personality of Chauvelin as a well-known leader of the regicide government was inherently distasteful to him. But the prince saw in the wizened little figure before him an obvious butt for his friend Blakeney's impertinent shafts, and although historians have been unable to assert positively whether or no George, Prince of Wales, knew aught of Sir Percy's dual life, yet there is no doubt that he was always ready to enjoy a situation which brought about the discomfiture of any of the Scarlet Pimpernel's avowed enemies. "I too have not met Monsieur Chauvelin for many a long month," said His Royal Highness with an obvious show of irony. "And I mistake not, sir, you left my father's court somewhat abruptly last year." "Nay, Your Royal Highness," said Percy gaily, "my friend Monsieur, Chaubertin and I had serious business to discuss which could only be dealt with in France. Am I not right, Monsieur?"
"Quite right, Sir Percy," replied Chauvelin curtly.
"We had to discuss abominable soup in Calais, had we not?" continued Blakeney in the same tone of easy banter, "and wine that I vowed was vinegar. Monsieur, Chaubertin, no, I beg your pardon, Chauvelin. Monsieur Chauvelin and I quite agreed upon that point. The only matter on which we were not quite at one was the question of snuff."
"Snuff!" laughed His Royal Highness, who seemed vastly amused.
"Yes, Your Royal Highness, snuff. Monsieur Chauvelin here had, if I may be allowed to say so, so vitiated a taste in snuff that he prefers it with an admixture of pepper. Is that not so, Monsieur, Chaubertin?"
"Chauvelin, Sir Percy," remarked the ex-ambassador dryly.
He was determined not to lose his temper and looked urbane and pleasant, whilst his impudent enemy was enjoying a joke at his expense. Marguerite, the while, had not taken her eyes off the keen, shrewd face. Whilst the three men talked, she seemed suddenly to have lost her sense of the reality of things. The present situation appeared to her strangely familiar, like a dream which she had dreamt oft-times before. Suddenly it became absolutely clear to her that the whole scene had been arranged and planned. The booth with its flaring placard, Demoiselle Candeille soliciting her patronage, her invitation to the young actress, Chauvelin's sudden appearance, all had been concocted and arranged, not here, not in England at all, but out there in Paris, in some dark gathering of bloodthirsty ruffians who had invented a final trap for the destruction of the bold adventurer who went by the name of the Scarlet Pimpernel. And she also was only a puppet, enacting a part which had been written for her. She had acted just as they had anticipated, had spoken the very words they had meant her to say, and when she looked at Percy, he seemed supremely ignorant of it all, unconscious of this trap of the existence of which everyone here present was aware, save indeed himself. She would have fought against this weird feeling of obsession, of being a mechanical toy, wound up to do certain things, but this she could not do. Her will appeared paralyzed, her tongue even refused her service. As in a dream she heard His Royal Highness ask for the name of the young actress who was soliciting alms for the poor of Paris. That also had been prearranged. His Royal Highness, for the moment, was also a puppet, made to dance, to speak, and to act as Chauvelin and his colleagues over in France had decided that he should. Quite mechanically, Marguerite introduced Demoiselle Candeille to the prince's gracious notice. "If Your Highness will permit," she said, "Mademoiselle Candeille will give us some of her charming old French songs at my rout tomorrow."
By all means," said the prince. "I used to know some in my childhood days. Charming and poetic. I know. We shall be delighted to hear Mademoiselle sing, eh, Blakeney?" he added good-humouredly. "And for your rout tomorrow, will you not also invite Monsieur Chauvelin?"
"Nay, but that goes without saying, Your Royal Highness," responded Sir Percy with hospitable alacrity, and a most approved bow directed at his arch-enemy. "We shall expect Monsieur Chauvelin. He and I have not met for so long, and he shall be made right welcome at Blakeney Manor."
End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in January 2008. Chapter 9. Demoiselle Candeille. Her origin was of the humblest, for her mother, so it was said, had been kitchen-maid in the household of the Duc de Marny, but Désirée had received some kind of education, and though she began life as a dresser in one of the minor theatres of Paris, she became, ultimately, one of its most popular stars. She was small and dark, dainty in her manner and ways, and with a graceful little figure, peculiarly supple and sinuous. Her humble origin certainly did not betray itself in her hands and feet, which were exquisite in shape and Lilliputian in size. Her hair was soft and glossy, always free from powder, and cunningly arranged so as to slightly overshadow the upper part of her face. The chin was small and round, the mouth extraordinarily red, the neck slender and long. But she was not pretty, so said all the women. Her skin was rather coarse in texture and darkish in colour. Her eyes were narrow and slightly turned upwards at the corners. No, she was distinctly not pretty. Yet she pleased the men, perhaps because she was so artlessly determined to please them. The women said that Demoiselle Candeille never left a man alone until she had succeeded in captivating his fancy, if only for 5 minutes. An interval in a dance, the time to cross a muddy road. But for 5 minutes she was determined to hold any man's complete attention, and to exact his admiration. And she nearly always succeeded. Therefore the women hated her. The men were amused. It is extremely pleasant to have one's admiration compelled, one's attention so determinately sought after. And Candeille could be extremely amusing, and as Madelon in Molière's Les Précieuses was quite inimitable. This, however, was in the olden days, just before Paris went quite mad, before the reign of terror had set in, and ci-devant Louis the King had been executed. Candeille had taken it into her frolicsome little head that she would like to go to London. The idea was, of course, in the nature of an experiment. Those dull English people over the water knew so little of what good acting really meant. Tragedy? Well, passons. Their heavy, large-boned actresses might manage one or two big scenes where a commanding presence and a powerful voice would not come amiss, and where prominent teeth would pass unnoticed in the agony of a dramatic climax. But comedy? Ah! Saint-Nos, par exemple. Demoiselle Candeille had seen several English gentlemen and ladies in those same olden days at the Tuileries, but she really could not imagine any of them enacting the piquant scenes of Molière or Beaumarchais. Demoiselle Candeille thought of every English-born individual as having very large teeth. Now large teeth do not lend themselves to well-spoken comedy scenes, to smiles, or to double entendre. Her own teeth were exceptionally small and white and very sharp, like those of a kitten. Yes, Demoiselle Candeille thought it would be extremely interesting to go to London and to show to a nation of shopkeepers how daintily one can be amused in a theatre. Permission to depart from Paris was easy to obtain. In fact, the fair lady had never really found it difficult to obtain anything she very much wanted. In this case she had plenty of friends in high places. Marat was still alive and a great lover of the theatre. Tallien was a personal admirer of hers. Deputy Dupont would do anything she asked. She wanted to act in London, at a theatre called Drury Lane. She wanted to play Molière in England in French, and had already spoken with several of her colleagues who were ready to join her. They would give public representations in aid of the starving population of France. There were plenty of socialistic clubs in London, quite Jacobin and revolutionary in tendency. Their members would give her full support. She would be serving her country and her countrymen, and incidentally see something of the world and amuse herself. She was bored in Paris. Then she thought of Marguerite Saint-Just, once of the Maison Molière, who had captivated an English milord of enormous wealth. Demoiselle Candeille had never been of the Maison Molière. She had been the leading star of one of the minor, yet much frequented, theatres of Paris, but she felt herself quite able and ready to captivate some other unattached milord, who would load her with English money and, incidentally, bestow an English name upon her. So she went to London. The experiment, however, had not proved an unmitigated success. At first she and her company did obtain a few engagements at one or two of the minor theatres to give representations of some of the French classical comedies in the original language. But these never quite became the fashion.
The feeling against France and all her doings was far too keen in that very set which Demoiselle Candeille had desired to captivate with her talents, to allow of the English jeunesse dorée to flock and see Molière played in French by a French troupe, whilst Candeille's own compatriots resident in England had given her but scant support. One section of these, the aristocrats and émigrés, looked upon the actress who was a friend of all the Jacobins in Paris as nothing better than canaille. They sedulously ignored her presence in this country, and snubbed her whenever they had an opportunity. The other section, chiefly consisting of agents and spies of the revolutionary government, she would gladly have ignored. They had at first made a constant demand on her purse, her talents, and her time. Then she grew tired of them, and felt more and more chary of being identified with a set which was in such ill odour with that very same jeunesse dorée whom Candeille had desired to please. In her own country she was, and always had been, a good republican. Marat had given her her first start in life by his violent praises of her talent in his widely circulated paper. She had been associated in Paris with the whole coterie of artists and actors, every one of them republican to a man. But in London, although one might be snubbed by the émigrés and aristocrats, it did not do to be mixed up with the sans-culottes journalists and pamphleteers who haunted the socialistic clubs of the English capital, and who were the prime organisers of all those seditious gatherings and treasonable unions that caused Mr. Pitt and his colleagues so much trouble and anxiety. One by one Désiré Candeille's comrades, male and female, who had accompanied her to England, returned to their own country. When war was declared, some of them were actually sent back under the provisions of the Aliens Bill. But Désiré had stayed on. Her old friends in Paris had managed to advise her that she would not be very welcome there just now. The sans-culottes journalists of England, the agents and spies of the revolutionary government, had taken their revenge of the frequent snubs inflicted upon them by the young actress, and in those days the fact of being unwelcome in France was apt to have a more lurid and more dangerous significance. Candeille did not dare return, at any rate not for the present. She trusted to her own powers of intrigue and her well-known fascinations to reconquer the friendship of the Jacobin clique, and she once more turned her attention to the affiliated socialistic clubs of England. But between the proverbial two stools Demoiselle Candeille soon came to the ground. Her machinations became known in official quarters, her connection with all the seditious clubs of London was soon bruited abroad, and one evening Désiré found herself confronted with a document addressed to her, from the office of His Majesty's Privy Seal, wherein it was set forth that, pursuant to the Statute 33, George III, Cap 5, she, Désiré Candeille, a French subject now resident in England, was required to leave this kingdom by order of His Majesty within 7 days, and that in the event of the said Désiré Candeille refusing to comply with this order, she would be liable to commitment, brought to trial, and sentenced to imprisonment for a month, and afterwards to removal within a limited time under pain of transportation for life. This meant that Demoiselle Candeille had exactly 7 days in which to make complete her reconciliation with her former friends, who now ruled Paris and France with a relentless and perpetually blood-stained hand. No wonder that during the night which followed the receipt of this momentous document, Demoiselle Candeille suffered gravely from insomnia. She dared not go back to France. She was ordered out of England. What was to become of her? This was just 3 days before the eventful afternoon of the Richmond Gala, and 24 hours after ex-ambassador Chauvelin had landed in England. Candeille and Chauvelin had since then met at the Cercle des Jacobins Français in Soho Street, and now Frère Désiré found herself in lodgings in Richmond, the evening of the day following the gala, feeling that her luck had not altogether deserted her. One conversation with citizen Chauvelin had brought the fickle jade back to Demoiselle Candeille's service. Nay, more, the young actress saw before her visions of intrigue, of dramatic situations, of pleasant little bits of revenge, all of which was meat and drink and air to breathe for Demoiselle Désirée. She was to sing in one of the most fashionable salons in England. That was very pleasant. The Prince of Wales would hear and see her. That opened out a vista of delightful possibilities. And all she had to do was to act a part dictated to her by citizen Chauvelin, to behave as he directed, to move in the way he wished. Well, that was easy enough, since the part which she would have to play was one peculiarly suited to her talents. She looked at herself critically in the glass. Her maid Fanchon, a little French waif picked up in the slums of Soho, helped to readjust a stray curl which had rebelled against the comb. "Now for the necklace, mademoiselle," said Fanchon with suppressed excitement. It had just arrived by messenger, a large morocco case which now lay open on the dressing-table, displaying its dazzling contents. Candeille scarcely dared to touch it, and yet it was for her. Citizen Chauvelin had sent a note with it. Citizeness Candeille would please accept this gift from the government of France in acknowledgment of useful services past and to come. The note was signed with Robespierre's own name, followed by that of Citizen Chauvelin. The Morocco case contained a necklace of diamonds worth the ransom of a king. For useful services past and to come, and there were promises of still further rewards, a complete pardon for all defalcations, a place within the charmed circle of the Comédie Française, a grand pageant and apotheosis with Citizeness Candeille impersonating the goddess of reason in the midst of a grand national fête, and the acclamations of excited Paris, and all in exchange for the enactment of a part, simple and easy, outlined for her by Chauvelin. How strange! How inexplicable! Candeille took the necklace up in her trembling fingers and gazed musingly at the priceless gems. She had seen the jewels before, long, long ago, round the neck of the Duchesse de Marny, in whose service her own mother had been. She, as a child, had often gazed at and admired the great lady, who seemed like a wonderful fairy from an altogether different world, to the poor little kitchen slut. How wonderful are the vagaries of fortune! Désirée Candeille, the kitchen-maid's daughter, now wearing her ex-mistress's jewels. She supposed that these had been confiscated when the last of the Marnies, the girl Juliet, had escaped from France, confiscated and now sent to her, Candeille, as a reward or as a bribe. In either case, they were welcome. The actress's vanity was soothed. She knew Juliet Marny was in England, and that she would meet her tonight at Lady Blakeney's. After the many snubs which she had endured from French aristocrats settled in England, the actress felt that she was about to enjoy an evening of triumph. The intrigue excited her. She did not quite know what schemes Chauvelin was aiming at, what ultimate end he had had in view when he commanded her services and taught her the part which he wished her to play. That the schemes were vast and the end mighty she could not doubt. The reward she had received was proof enough of that. Little Fanchon stood there in speechless admiration whilst her mistress still fondly fingered the magnificent necklace. "Mademoiselle will wear the diamond tonight?" she asked with evident anxiety. She would have been bitterly disappointed to have seen the beautiful thing once more relegated to its dark Morocco case. "Oh yes, Fanchon," said Candeille with a sigh of great satisfaction. "See that they are fastened quite securely, my girl." She put the necklace round her shapely neck, and Fanchon looked to see that the clasp was quite secure. There came the sound of loud knocking at the street door. "That is Monsieur Chauvelin come to fetch me with the chaise. Am I quite ready, Fanchon?" asked Désirée Candeille. "Oh yes, mademoiselle," sighed the little maid, "and mademoiselle looks very beautiful tonight." "Lady Blakeney is very beautiful too, Fanchon," rejoined the actress naively, "but I wonder if she will wear anything as fine as the Marny necklace." The knocking at the street door was repeated. Candeille took a final satisfied survey of herself in the glass. She knew her part, and felt that she had dressed well for it. She gave a final affectionate little tap to the diamonds round her neck, took her cloak and hood from Fanchon, and was ready to go. End of chapter 9. Chapter 10 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orczy. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in January 2008. Chapter 10. Lady Blakeney's Rout. There are several accounts extant, in the fashionable chronicles of the time, of the gorgeous reception given that autumn by Lady Blakeney in her magnificent riverside home. Never had the spacious apartments of Blakeney Manor looked more resplendent than on this memorable occasion, memorable because of the events which brought the brilliant evening to a close. The Prince of Wales had come over by water from Carlton House. The royal princesses came early, and all fashionable London was there, chattering and laughing, displaying elaborate gowns and priceless jewels, dancing, flirting, listening to the strains of the string band, or strolling listlessly in the gardens, where the late roses and clumps of heliotrope threw soft fragrance on the balmy air. But Marguerite was nervous and agitated. Strive how she might, she could not throw off that foreboding of something evil to come, which had assailed her from the first moment when she met Chauvelin face to face. That unaccountable feeling of unreality was still upon her, that sense that she and the woman Candeille, Percy and even His Royal Highness, were, for the time being, the actors in a play written and stage-managed by Chauvelin. The ex-ambassador's humility, his offers of friendship, his quietude under Sir Percy's good-humoured banter— everything was a sham. Marguerite knew it. Her womanly instinct, her passionate love, all cried out to her in warning. But there was that in her husband's nature which rendered her powerless in the face of such dangers as, she felt sure, were now threatening him. Just before her guests had begun to assemble, she had been alone with him for a few minutes. She had entered the room in which he sat, looking radiantly beautiful in a shimmering gown of white and silver, with diamonds in her golden hair and round her exquisite neck. Moments like this, when she was alone with him, were the joy of her life. Then and only then did she see him as he really was, with that wistful tenderness in his deep-set eyes, that occasional flash of passion from beneath the lazily drooping lids. For a few minutes, seconds mayhap, the spirit of the reckless adventurer was laid to rest, relegated into the furthermost background of his senses by the powerful emotions of the lover. Then he would seize her in his arms and hold her to him, with a strange longing to tear from out his heart all other thoughts, feelings, and passions, save those which made him a slave to her beauty and her smiles. "Percy," she whispered to him tonight, when freeing herself from his embrace she looked up at him, and for this one heavenly second felt him all her own. "Percy, you will do nothing rash, nothing foolhardy tonight. That man had planned all that took place yesterday. He hates you, and..." In a moment his face and attitude had changed. The heavy lids drooped over the eyes, the rigidity of the mouth relaxed, and that quaint, half-shy, half-inane smile played around the firm lips. "Of course he does, my dear," he said in his usual affected, drawly tones. "Of course he does. But that is so demmed amusing. He does not really know what or how much he knows, or what I know. In fact, we none of us know anything, just at present." He laughed, lightly and carelessly, then deliberately readjusted the set of his lace tie. "Percy," she said reproachfully. "Yes, my dear." "Lately, when you brought Déroulède and Juliette Marny to England, I endured agonies of anxiety, and..." He sighed, a quick, short, wistful sigh, and said very gently, "I know you did, my dear, and that is where the trouble lies. I know that you are fretting, so I have to be so demmed quick about the business, so as not to keep you in suspense too long. And now I can't take folks away from his young wife, and Tony and the others are so mighty slow." "Percy," she said once more with earnest tenderness. "I know, I know," he said with a slight frown of self-reproach. "La, but I don't deserve your solicitude. Heavens know what a brute I was for years whilst I neglected you and ignored the noble devotion which I, alas, do even now so little to deserve." She would have said something more, but was interrupted by the entrance of Juliette Marny into the room. "Some of your guests have arrived, Lady Blakeney," said the young girl, apologizing for her seeming intrusion. "I thought you would wish to know." Juliette looked very young and girlish, in a simple white gown, without a single jewel on her arms or neck. Marguerite regarded her with unaffected approval. "You look charming tonight, mademoiselle. Does she not, Sir Percy?" "Thanks to your bounty," smiled Juliette, a trifle sadly. "Whilst I dressed tonight, I felt how I should have loved to wear my mother's jewels, of which she used to be so proud." "We must hope that you will recover them, dear, some day," said Marguerite vaguely, as she led the young girl out of the small study towards the larger reception rooms. "Indeed I hope so," sighed Juliette. "When times became so troublous in France after my dear father's death, his confessor and friend, the Abbé Fouquet, took charge of all my mother's jewels for me. He said they would be safe with the ornaments of his own little church at Boulogne. He feared no sacrilege, and thought they would be most effectually hidden there, for no one would dream of looking for the Marny diamonds in the crypt of a country church." Marguerite said nothing in reply. Whatever her own doubts might be upon such a subject, it could serve no purpose to disturb the young girl's serenity. "Dear Abbé Fouquet," said Juliette after a while, "is this the kind of devotion which I feel sure will never be found under the new regimes of anarchy and of so-called equality? He would have laid down his life for my father or for me, and I know that he would never part with the jewels which I entrusted to his care whilst he had breath and strength to defend them." Marguerite would have wished to pursue the subject a little further. It was very pathetic to witness poor Juliette's hopes and confidences, which she felt sure would never be realized. Lady Blakeney knew so much of what was going on in France just now. Spoliations, confiscations, official thefts, open robberies, all in the name of equality, of fraternity, and of patriotism. She knew nothing, of course, of the Abbé Fouquet, but the tender little picture of the devoted old man, painted by Juliet's words, had appealed strongly to her sympathetic heart. Instinct and knowledge of the political aspect of France told her that by entrusting valuable family jewels to the old abbé, Juliet had most unwittingly placed the man she so much trusted in danger of persecution at the hands of a government which did not even admit the legality of family possessions. However, there was neither time nor opportunity now to enlarge upon the subject. Marguerite resolved to recur to it a little later, when she would be alone with Mademoiselle de Marny, and above all when she could take counsel with her husband as to the best means of recovering the young girl's property for her, whilst relieving a devoted old man from the dangerous responsibility which he had so selflessly undertaken. In the meanwhile, the two women had reached the first of the long line of state apartments wherein the brilliant fete was to take place. The staircase and the hall below were already filled with the early arrivals. Bidding Juliet to remain in the ballroom, Lady Blakeney now took up her stand on the exquisitely decorated landing, ready to greet her guests. She had a smile and a pleasant word for all, as, in a constant stream, the elite of London fashionable society began to file past her, exchanging the elaborate greetings which the stilted mode of the day prescribed to this butterfly world. The lackeys in the hall shouted the names of the guests as they passed up the stairs. Names celebrated in politics, in worlds of sport, of science, or of art, great historic names, humble, newly made ones, noble, illustrious titles. The spacious rooms were filling fast. His Royal Highness, so 'twas said, had just stepped out of his barge. The noise of laughter and chatter was incessant, like unto a crowd of gaily plumaged birds. Huge bunches of apricot-coloured roses in silver vases made the air heavy with their subtle perfume. Fans began to flutter. The string band struck the preliminary chords of the gavotte. At that moment the lackeys at the foot of the stairs called out in stentorian tones, "Mademoiselle Desiree Candeille and Monsieur Chauvelin." Marguerite's heart gave a slight flutter. She felt a sudden tightening of her throat. She did not see Candeille at first. Only the slight figure of Chauvelin, dressed all in black, as usual, with head bent and hands clasped behind his back. He was slowly mounting the wide staircase, between a double row of brilliantly attired men and women, who looked with no small measure of curiosity at the ex-ambassador from revolutionary France. Demoiselle Candeille was leading the way up the stairs. She paused on the landing in order to make before her hostess a most perfect and most elaborate curtsy. She looked smiling and radiant, beautifully dressed, a small wreath of wrought gold leaves in her hair, her only jewel an absolutely regal one, a magnificent necklace of diamonds round her shapely throat. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in January 2008. Chapter 11. The Challenge. It all occurred just before midnight, in one of the smaller rooms which lead an enfilade from the principal ballroom. Dancing had been going on for some time, but the evening was close, and there seemed to be a growing desire on the part of Lady Blakeney's guests to wander desultorily through the gardens and glasshouses, or sit about where some measure of coolness could be obtained. There was a rumour that a new and charming French artiste was to sing a few peculiarly ravishing songs unheard in England before. Close to the main ballroom was the octagon music room, which was brilliantly illuminated, and in which a large number of chairs had been obviously disposed for the comfort of an audience. Into this room many of the guests had already assembled. It was quite clear that a chamber concert, select and attractive as were all Lady Blakeney's entertainments, was in contemplation. Marguerite herself, released for a moment from her constant duties near her royal guests, had strolled through the smaller rooms, accompanied by Juliet, in order to search for Mademoiselle Candeille, and to suggest the commencement of the improvised concert. Désirée Candeille had kept herself very much aloof throughout the evening, only talking to the one or two gentlemen whom her hostess had presented to her on her arrival, and with Monsieur Chauvelin always in close attendance upon her every movement. Presently, when dancing began, she retired to a small boudoir, and there sat down, demurely waiting, until Lady Blakeney should require her services. When Marguerite and Juliet Marny entered the little room, she rose and came forward a few steps. "I am ready, madame," she said pleasantly, "whenever you wish me to begin. I have thought out a short programme. Shall I start with the gay or the sentimental songs?" But before Marguerite had time to utter a reply, she felt her arm nervously clutched by a hot and trembling hand. "Who is this woman?" murmured Juliet Marny close to her ear. The young girl looked pale and very agitated, and her large eyes were fixed in unmistakable wrath upon the French actress before her. A little startled, not understanding Juliet's attitude, Marguerite tried to reply lightly. "This is Mademoiselle Candeille, Juliet dear," she said, affecting the usual formal introduction, "of the Variété Theatre of Paris. Mademoiselle Désirée Candeille, who will sing some charming French ditties for us tonight." While she spoke, she kept a restraining hand on Juliet's quivering arm. Already with the keen intuition which had been on the qui-vive the whole evening, she scented some mystery in this sudden outburst on the part of her young protégé. But Juliet did not heed her. She felt surging up in her young, overburdened heart all the wrath and the contempt of the persecuted fugitive aristocrat against the triumphant usurper. She had suffered so much from that particular class of the risen kitchen wench of which the woman before her was so typical an example. Years of sorrow, of poverty, were behind her. Loss of fortune, of kindred, of friends. She, even now a pauper, living on the bounty of strangers. And all this through no fault of her own. The fault of her class, mayhap, but not hers. She had suffered much, and was still overwrought and nerve-strung. For some reason she could not afterwards have explained, she felt spiteful and uncontrolled, goaded into stupid fury by the look of insolence and of triumph with which Candeille calmly regarded her. Afterwards she would willingly have bitten out her tongue for her vehemence, but for the moment she was absolutely incapable of checking the torrent of her own emotions. "Mademoiselle Candeille, indeed!" she said in wrathful scorn. "Désirée Candeille, you mean, Lady Blakeney, my mother's kitchen-maid, flaunting shamelessly my dear mother's jewels which she has stolen, mayhap." The young girl was trembling from head to foot, tears of anger obscured her eyes, her voice, which fortunately remained low, not much above a whisper, was thick and husky. "Juliet, Juliet, I entreat you," admonished Marguerite, "you must control yourself, you must, indeed you must. Mademoiselle Candeille, I beg of you to retire." But Candeille, well schooled in the part she had to play, had no intention of quitting the field of battle. The more wrathful and excited Mademoiselle de Marny became, the more insolent and triumphant waxed the young actress's whole attitude. An ironical smile played around the corners of her mouth. Her almond-shaped eyes were half-closed, regarding through drooping lashes the trembling figure of the young, impoverished aristocrat. Her head was thrown well back, in obvious defiance of the social conventions which should have forbidden a fracas in Lady Blakeney's hospitable house, and her fingers provocatively toyed with the diamond necklace which glittered and sparkled round her throat. She had no need to repeat the words of a well-learned part. Her own wit, her own emotions and feelings, helped her to act just as her employer would have wished her to do. Her native vulgarity helped her to assume the very bearing which he would have desired. In fact, at this moment, Désirée Candeille had forgotten everything save the immediate present. A more than contemptuous snub from one of those penniless aristocrats who had rendered her own sojourn in London so unpleasant and unsuccessful. She had suffered from these snubs before, but had never had the chance of forcing an esclandre as a result of her own humiliation. That spirit of hatred for the rich and idle classes, which was so characteristic of revolutionary France, was alive and hot within her. She had never had an opportunity, she, the humble fugitive actress from a minor Paris theatre, to retort with forcible taunts to the ironical remarks made at and before her by the various poverty-stricken but haughty émigrés who swarmed in those very same circles of London society into which she herself had vainly striven to penetrate. Now at last, one of this same hated class, provoked beyond self-control, was allowing childish and unreasoning fury to outstrip the usual calm irony of aristocratic rebuffs. Juliet had paused a while, in order to check the wrathful tears which, much against her will, were choking the words in her throat and blinding her eyes. "Hoity-toity," laughed Candeille, "hug the young baggage." But Juliet had turned to Marguerite and began explaining volubly. "My mother's jewels," she said in the midst of her tears. "Ask her how she came by them. When I was obliged to leave the home of my fathers, stolen from me by the revolutionary government, I contrived to retain my mother's jewels. You remember, I told you just now, the Abbé Fouquet, dear old man, saved them for me, that and a little money which I had. He took charge of them. He said he would place them in safety with the ornaments of his church, and now I see them round that woman's neck. I know that he would not have parted with them save with his life." All the while that the young girl spoke in a voice half-choked with sobs, Marguerite tried with all the physical and mental will at her command to drag her out of the room, and thus to put a summary ending to this unpleasant scene. She ought to have felt angry with Juliet for this childish and senseless outburst, were it not for the fact that somehow
she knew within her innermost heart that all this had been arranged and preordained, not by fate, not by a higher hand, but by the most skilful intriguer present-day France had ever known. And even now, as she was half succeeding in turning Juliet away from the sight of Candeille, she was not the least surprised or startled at seeing Chauvelin standing in the very doorway through which she had hoped to pass. One glance at his face had made her fears tangible and real. There was a look of satisfaction and triumph in his pale, narrow eyes, a flash in them of approbation directed at the insolent attitude of the French actress. He looked like the stage manager of a play, content with the effect his own well-arranged scenes were producing. What he hoped to gain by this somewhat vulgar quarrel between the two women, Marguerite, of course, could not guess. That something was lurking in his mind, inimical to herself and to her husband, she did not for a moment doubt, and at this moment she felt that she would have given her very life to induce Candeille and Juliette to cease this passage of arms without further provocation on either side. But though Juliette might have been ready to yield to Lady Blakeney's persuasion, Désirée Candeille, under Chauvelin's eye, and fired by her own desire to further humiliate this overbearing aristocrat, did not wish the little scene to end so tamely just yet. "Your old calotin is made to part with his booty, my dear," she said, with a contemptuous shrug of her bare shoulders. "Paris and France have been starving these many years past. A paternal government seized all it could, with which to reward those that served it well, whilst all that would have been brought bread and meat for the poor was being greedily stowed away by shameless traitors." Juliet winced at the insult. "Oh," she moaned, as she buried her flaming face in her hands. Too late now did she realize that she had deliberately stirred up a mud-heap and sent noisome insects buzzing about her ears. "Mademoiselle," said Marguerite authoritatively, "I must ask you to remember that Mademoiselle de Marny is my friend, and that you are a guest in my house."
I try not to forget it," rejoined Candeille lightly. "But of a truth you must admit, citizeness, that it would require the patience of a saint to put up with the insolence of a penniless baggage who but lately has had to stand her trial in her own country for impurity of conduct."
There was a moment's silence, whilst Marguerite distinctly heard a short sigh of satisfaction escaping from the lips of Chauvelin. Then a pleasant laugh broke upon the ears of the four actors who were enacting the dramatic little scene, and Sir Percy Blakeney, immaculate in his rich white satin coat and filmy lace ruffles, exquisite in manners and courtesy, entered the little boudoir, and with his long back slightly bent, his arm outstretched in a graceful and well-studied curve, he approached Mademoiselle Désirée Candeille. "May I have the honour," he said with his most elaborate air of courtly deference, "of conducting Mademoiselle to her chaise?" In the doorway just behind him stood His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, chatting with apparent carelessness to Sir Andrew Ffoulkes and Lord Anthony Dewhurst. A curtain beyond the open door was partially drawn aside, disclosing one or two brilliantly dressed groups strolling desultorily through the further rooms. The four persons assembled in the little boudoir had been so absorbed by their own passionate emotions and the violence of their quarrel that they had not noticed the approach of Sir Percy Blakeney and of his friends. Juliet and Marguerite certainly were startled, and Candeille was evidently taken unawares. Chauvelin alone seemed quite indifferent, and stood back a little when Sir Percy advanced, in order to allow him to pass. But Candeille recovered quickly enough from her surprise. Without heeding Blakeney's preferred arm, she turned with all the airs of an insulted tragedy queen towards Marguerite. "So 'tis I," she said with affected calm, "who am to bear every insult in a house in which I was bidden as a guest. I am turned out like some intrusive and importunate beggar, and I, the stranger in this land, am destined to find that, amidst all these brilliant English gentlemen, there is not one man of honour. Monsieur Chauvelin," she added loudly, "our beautiful country has, meseems, deputed you to guard the honour as well as the worldly goods of your unprotected compatriots. I call upon you, in the name of France, to avenge the insults offered to me to-night." She looked round defiantly from one to the other of the several faces, which were now turned towards her, but no one for the moment spoke or stirred. Juliet, silent and ashamed, had taken Marguerite's hand in hers, and was clinging to it as if wishing to draw strength of character and firmness of purpose through the pores of the other woman's delicate skin. Sir Percy, with backbone still bent in a sweeping curve, had not relaxed his attitude of uttermost deference. The Prince of Wales and his friends were viewing the scene with slightly amused aloofness. For a moment, seconds at most, there was dead silence in the room, during which time it almost seemed as if the beating of several hearts could be distinctly heard. Then Chauvelin, courtly and urbane, stepped calmly forward.
"Believe me, citizeness," he said, addressing Candeille directly and with marked emphasis, "I am entirely at your command. But am I not helpless, seeing that those who have so grossly insulted you are of your own irresponsible, if charming, sex?" Like a great dog after a nap, Sir Percy Blakeney straightened his long back and stretched it out to its full length. "La," he said pleasantly, "my ever-engaging friend from Calais. Sir, your servant. Meseems we are ever destined to discuss amiable matters in an amiable spirit. A glass of punch, Monsieur... Chauvelin?" "I must ask you, Sir Percy," rejoined Chauvelin sternly, "to view this matter with becoming seriousness." "Seriousness is never becoming, sir," said Blakeney, politely smothering a slight yawn, "and it is vastly unbecoming in the presence of ladies." "Am I to understand then, Sir Percy," said Chauvelin, "that you are prepared to apologize to Mademoiselle Candeille for the insults offered to her by Lady Blakeney?" Sir Percy again tried to smother that tiresome little yawn, which seemed most distressing, when he desired to be most polite. Then he flicked off a grain of dust from his immaculate lace ruffle, and buried his long, slender hands in the capacious pockets of his white satin breeches. Finally he said, with the most good-natured of smiles, "Sir, have you seen the latest fashion in cravats? I would wish to draw your attention to the novel way in which we in England tie a Mechlin-edged bow." "Sir Percy," retorted Chauvelin firmly, "since you will not offer Mademoiselle Candeille the apology which she has the right to expect from you, are you prepared that you and I should cross swords like honourable gentlemen?" Blakeney laughed his usual pleasant, somewhat shy laugh, shook his powerful frame, and looked from his altitude of 6 feet 3 inches down on the small sable-clad figure of ex-ambassador Chauvelin. "The question is, sir," he said slowly, "should we then be two honourable gentlemen crossing swords?" "Sir Percy." "Sir." Chauvelin, who for one moment had seemed ready to lose his temper, now made a sudden effort to resume a calm and easy attitude, and said quietly, "Of course, if one of us is coward enough to shirk the contest." He did not complete the sentence, but shrugged his shoulders expressive of contempt. The other side of the curtained doorway, a little crowd had gradually assembled, attracted hither by the loud and angry voices which came from that small boudoir. Host and hostess had been missed from the reception rooms for some time. His Royal Highness, too, had not been seen for the quarter of an hour. Like flies attracted by the light, one by one or in small, isolated groups, some of Lady Blakeney's guests had found their way to the room adjoining the royal presence. As His Highness was standing in the doorway itself, no one could, of course, cross the threshold, but everyone could see into the room, and could take stock of the various actors in the little comedy. They were witnessing a quarrel between the French envoy and Sir Percy Blakeney, wherein the former was evidently in deadly earnest, and the latter merely politely bored. Amused comments flew to and fro. Laughter and a babble of irresponsible chatter made an incessant chirruping accompaniment to the duologue between the two men. But at this stage, the Prince of Wales, who hitherto had seemingly kept aloof from the quarrel, suddenly stepped forward and abruptly interposed the weight of his authority and of his social position between the bickering adversaries. "Tush, man," he said impatiently, turning more especially towards Chauvelin, "you talk at random. Sir Percy Blakeney is an English gentleman, and the laws of this country do not admit of duelling, as you understand it in France. And I for one certainly could not allow..." "Pardon, Your Royal Highness," interrupted Sir Percy with irresistible bonhomie, "Your Highness does not understand the situation. My engaging friend here does not propose that I should transgress the laws of this country, but that I should go over to France with him and fight him there, where duelling and, other little matters of that sort are allowed." "Yes, quite so," rejoined the Prince. "I understand Monsieur Chauvelin's desire. But what about you, Blakeney?" "Oh," replied Sir Percy lightly, "I have accepted his challenge, of course." End of chapter 11. Chapter 12 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in January 2008. Chapter 12. Time, Place, Conditions. It would be very difficult indeed to say why, at Blakeney's lightly spoken words, an immediate silence should have fallen upon all those present. All the actors in the little drawing-room drama who had played their respective parts so unerringly up to now had paused a while, just as if an invisible curtain had come down, marking the end of a scene and the interval during which the players might recover strength and energy to resume their roles. The Prince of Wales, as foremost spectator, said nothing for the moment, and beyond the doorway,
The audience there assembled seemed suddenly to be holding its breath, waiting, eager, expectant, palpitating, for what would follow now. Only here and there the gentle frou-frou of a silk skirt, the rhythmic flutter of a fan, broke those few seconds' deadly, stony silence. And yet it was all simple enough. A fracas between two ladies, the gentleman interposing, a few words of angry expostulation, then the inevitable suggestion of Belgium or of some other country where the childish and barbarous custom of settling such matters with a couple of swords had not been as yet systematically stamped out. The whole scene, with but slight variations, had occurred scores of times in London drawing-rooms. English gentlemen had scores of times crossed the Channel for the purpose of settling similar quarrels in continental fashion. Why should the present situation appear so abnormal? Sir Percy Blakeney, an accomplished gentleman, was past master in the art of fence, and looked more than a match in strength and dexterity for the meagre, sable-clad little opponent who had so summarily challenged him to cross over to France in order to fight a duel. But somehow everyone had a feeling at this moment that this proposed duel would be unlike any other combat ever fought between two antagonists. Perhaps it was the white, absolutely stony and inexpressive face of Marguerite which suggested a latent tragedy. Perhaps it was the look of unmistakable horror in Juliet's eyes, or that of triumph in those of Chauvelin, or even that certain something in His Royal Highness's face which seemed to imply that the prince, careless man of the world as he was, would have given much to prevent this particular meeting from taking place. Be that as it may, there is no doubt that a certain wave of electrical excitement swept over the little crowd assembled there, the while the chief actor in the little drama, the inimitable dandy Sir Percy Blakeney himself, appeared deeply engrossed in removing a speck of powder from the wide black satin ribbon which held his gold-rimmed eyeglass. "Gentlemen," said His Royal Highness suddenly, "we are forgetting the ladies. My Lord Hastings," he added, turning to one of the gentlemen who stood close to him, "I pray you to remedy this unpardonable neglect. Men's quarrels are not fit for ladies' dainty ears." Sir Percy looked up from his absorbing occupation. His eyes met those of his wife. She was like a marble statue, hardly conscious of what was going on around her. But he, who knew every emotion which swayed that ardent and passionate nature, guessed that beneath that stony calm there lay a mad, almost unconquerable impulse, and that was to shout to all these puppets here the truth, the awful, the unanswerable truth, to tell them what this challenge really meant. A trap, wherein one man consumed with hatred and desire for revenge hoped to entice a brave and fearless foe into a death-dealing snare. Full well did Percy Blakeney guess that for the space of 1 second his most cherished secret hovered upon his wife's lips. One turn of the balance of fate, one breath from the mouth of an unseen sprite, and Marguerite was ready to shout, "Do not allow this monstrous thing to be! The Scarlet Pimpernel, whom you all admire for his bravery and love for his daring, stands before you now, face to face with his deadliest enemy, who is here to lure him to his doom!" For that momentous second, therefore, Percy Blakeney held his wife's gaze with the magnetism of his own. All there was in him of love, of entreaty, of trust, and of command, went out to her through that look with which he kept her eyes riveted upon his face. Then he saw the rigidity of her attitude relax. She closed her eyes in order to shut out the whole world from her suffering soul. She seemed to be gathering all the mental force of which her brain was capable for one great effort of self-control. Then she took Juliet's hand in hers, and turned to go out of the room. The gentleman bowed as she swept past them, her rich silken gown making a soft sh-sh-sh as she went. She nodded to some, curtsied to the prince, and had at the last moment the supreme courage and pride to turn her head once more towards her husband, in order to reassure him finally that his secret was as safe with her now, in this hour of danger, as it had been in the time of triumph. She smiled and passed out of his sight, preceded by Désiré Candeille, who, escorted by one of the gentlemen, had become singularly silent and subdued. In the little room now there only remained a few men. Sir Andrew Ffoulkes had taken the precaution of closing the door after the ladies had gone. Then His Royal Highness turned once more to Monsieur Chauvelin, and said with an obvious show of indifference, "Faith, monsieur, meseems we are all enacting a farce which can have no final act. I vow that I cannot allow my friend Blakeney to go over to France at your bidding. Your government now will not allow my father's subjects to land on your shores without a special passport, and then only for a specific purpose." "La, Your Royal Highness," interposed Sir Percy, "I pray you have no fear for me on that score.
My engaging friend here has, and I mistake not, a passport ready for me in the pocket of his sable-hued coat, and as we are hoping effectually to spit one another over there, gadzooks, but there's the specific purpose. Is it not true, sir," he added, turning once more to Chauvelin, "that in the pocket of that exquisitely cut coat of yours you have a passport, name in blank, perhaps, which you had specially designed for me?" It was so carelessly, so pleasantly said, that no one save Chauvelin guessed the real import of Sir Percy's words. Chauvelin, of course, knew their inner meaning. He understood that Blakeney wished to convey to him the fact that he was well aware that the whole scene tonight had been prearranged, and that it was willingly and with eyes wide open that he walked into the trap which the revolutionary patriot had so carefully laid for him. "The passport will be forthcoming in due course, sir," retorted Chauvelin evasively, "when our seconds have arranged all formalities." "Seconds be demmed, sir," rejoined Sir Percy placidly. "You do not propose, I trust, that we travel a whole caravan to France."
"Time, place, and conditions must be settled, Sir Percy," replied Chauvelin. "You are too accomplished a cavalier, I feel sure, to wish to arrange such formalities yourself."
"Nay, neither you nor I, Monsieur, Chauvelin," quoth Sir Percy blandly, "could, I own, settle such things with persistent good humour, and good humour in such cases is the most important of all formalities. Is it not so?"
"Certainly, Sir Percy.
As for seconds, perish the thought. One second only, I entreat, and that one a lady, the most adorable, the most detestable, the most true, the most fickle amidst all her charming sex. Do you agree, sir?"
"You have not told me her name, Sir Percy."
"Chance, monsieur, chance! With His Royal Highness' permission, let the wilful jade decide."
"I do not understand."
"Three throws of the dice, monsieur. Time, place, conditions, you said. Three throws, and the winner names them. Do you agree?"
Chauvelin hesitated.
Sir Percy's bantering mood did not quite fit in with his own elaborate plans. Moreover, the ex-ambassador feared a pitfall of some sort, and did not quite like to trust to this arbitration of the dice-box. He turned quite involuntarily in appeal to the Prince of Wales and the other gentlemen present. But the Englishman of those days was a born gambler. He lived with the dice-box in one pocket and a pack of cards in the other. The Prince himself was no exception to this rule, and the first gentleman in England was the most avowed worshipper of hazard in the land.
"Chance, by all means," quoth His Highness gaily.
"Chance, chance," repeated the others eagerly. In the midst of so hostile a crowd, Chauvelin felt it unwise to resist. Moreover, one second's reflection had already assured him that this throwing of the dice could not seriously interfere with the success of his plans. If the meeting took place at all, and Sir Percy had now gone too far to draw back, then of necessity it would have to take place in France. The question of time and conditions of the fight, which at best would be only a farce, only a means to an end, could not be of paramount importance. Therefore he shrugged his shoulders with well-marked indifference and said lightly, "As you please." There was a small table in the centre of the room, with a settee and two or three chairs arranged close to it. Around this table now an eager little group had congregated. The Prince of Wales in the forefront, unwilling to interfere, scarce knowing what madcap plans were floating through Blakeney's adventurous brain, but excited in spite of himself at this momentous game of hazard the issues of which seemed so nebulous, so vaguely fraught with dangers. Close to him were Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, Lord Antony Dewhurst, Lord Grenville, and perhaps a half-score gentlemen, young men about town mostly, gay and giddy butterflies of fashion, who did not even attempt to seek in this strange game of chance any hidden meaning, save that it was one of Blakeney's irresponsible pranks. And in the centre of the compact group, Sir Percy Blakeney, in his gorgeous suit of shimmering white satin, one knee bent upon a chair, and leaning with easy grace, dice-box in hand, across the small gilt-legged table. Beside him, ex-ambassador Chauvelin, standing with arms folded behind his back, watching every movement of his brilliant adversary, like some dark-plumaged hawk hovering near a bird of paradise.
"Place first, monsieur?" suggested Sir Percy.
"As you will, sir," assented Chauvelin. He took up a dice-box which one of the gentlemen handed to him, and the two men threw.
"'Tis mine, monsieur," said Blakeney carelessly, "mine to name the place where shall occur this historic encounter twixt the busiest man in France and the most idle fop that e'er disgraced these three kingdoms. Just for the sake of argument, sir, what place would you suggest?"
"Oh, the exact spot is immaterial, Sir Percy," replied Chauvelin coldly. "The whole of France stands at your disposal."
"Aye, I thought as much, but could not be quite sure of such boundless hospitality," retorted Blakeney imperturbably.
"Do you care for the woods around Paris, sir?"
"Too far from the coast, sir. I might be seasick crossing over the Channel, and glad to get the business over as soon as possible. No, not Paris, sir. Rather, let us say, Boulogne. Pretty little place, Boulogne. Do you not think so?"
"Undoubtedly, Sir Percy. "Then Boulogne it is. The ramparts, an you will, on the south side of the town."
"As you please," rejoined Chauvelin dryly. "Shall we throw again?"
A murmur of merriment had accompanied this brief colloquy between the adversaries, and Blakeney's bland sallies were received with shouts of laughter. Now the dice rattled again, and once more the two men threw.
"'Tis yours this time, Monsieur Chauvelin," said Blakeney, after a rapid glance at the dice. "See how evenly chance favours us both. Mine the choice of place, admirably done, you'll confess. Now yours the choice of time. I wait upon your pleasure, sir. The southern ramparts at Boulogne, when?"
"The fourth day from this, sir. At the hour when the cathedral bell chimes the evening Angelus," came Chauvelin's ready reply.
"Nay, but methought that your demmed government had abolished cathedrals and bells and chimes. The people of France have now to go to hell their own way, for the way to heaven has been barred by the National Convention. Is that not so? Methought the Angelus was forbidden to be rung."
"Not at Boulogne, I think, Sir Percy," retorted Chauvelin dryly, "and I'll pledge you my word that the evening Angelus shall be rung that night."
"At what hour is that, sir?"
1 hour after sundown."
"But why 4 days after this? Why not two or three?"
"I might have asked, why the southern rampart, Sir Percy? Why not the western?"
"I chose the fourth day. Does it not suit you?" asked Chauvelin ironically.
"Suit me? Why, sir, nothing could suit me better," rejoined Blakeney with his pleasant laugh.
"Zounds, but I call it marvellous, demmed marvellous. I wonder now," he added blandly, "what made you think of the Angelus?"
Everyone laughed at this, a little irrelevantly perhaps.
"Ah," continued Blakeney gaily, "I remember now, faith, to think that I was nigh forgetting that when last you and I met, sir, you had just taken, or about to take, holy orders. Ah, how well the thought of the Angelus fits in with your clerical garb. I recollect that the latter was mightily becoming to you, sir."
"Shall we proceed to settle the conditions of the fight, Sir Percy?" said Chauvelin, interrupting the flow of his antagonist's gibes, and trying to disguise his irritation beneath a mask of impassive reserve.
"The choice of weapons, you mean," here interposed His Royal Highness. "But I thought that swords had already been decided on."
"Quite so, Your Highness," assented Blakeney.
"But there are various little matters in connection with this momentous encounter which are of vast importance. Am I not right, monsieur? Gentlemen, I appeal to you. Faith, one never knows. My engaging opponent here might desire that I should fight him in green socks, and I that he should wear a scarlet flower in his coat."
"The Scarlet Pimpernel, Sir Percy?"
"Why not, monsieur? It would look so well in your buttonhole against the black of the clerical coat, which, I understand, you sometime affect in France. And when it is withered and quite dead, you would find that it would leave an overpowering odour in your nostrils, far stronger than that of incense."
There was general laughter after this.
The hatred with which every member of the French revolutionary government, including, of course, ex-ambassador Chauvelin, bore to the national hero, was well known.
"The conditions, then, Sir Percy," said Chauvelin, without seeming to notice the taunt conveyed in Blakeney's last words. "Shall we throw again?"
"After you, sir," acquiesced Sir Percy.
For the third and last time the two opponents rattled the dice-box and threw. Chauvelin was now absolutely unmoved. These minor details quite failed to interest him. What mattered the conditions of the fight, which was only intended as a bait with which to lure his enemy in the open? The hour and place were decided on, and Sir Percy would not fail to come. Chauvelin knew enough of his opponent's boldly adventurous spirit not to feel in the least doubtful on that point. Even now, as he gazed with grudging admiration at the massive, well-knit figure of his arch-enemy, noted the thin, nervy hands and square jaw, the low, broad forehead and deep-set, half-veiled eyes, he knew that in this matter wherein Percy Blakeney was obviously playing with his very life, the only emotion that really swayed him at this moment was his passionate love of adventure. The ruling passion strong in death. Yes, Sir Percy would be on the southern ramparts of Boulogne 1 hour after sunset on the day named, trusting, no doubt, in his usual marvellous good fortune, his own presence of mind and his great physical and mental strength, to escape from the trap into which he was so ready to walk. That remained beyond a doubt. Therefore, what mattered details? But even at this moment, Chauvelin had already resolved on one great thing, namely, that on that eventful day, nothing whatever should be left to chance. He would meet his cunning enemy not only with cunning, but also with power, and if the entire force of the Republican army then available in the north of France had to be requisitioned for the purpose, the ramparts of Boulogne would be surrounded, and no chance of escape left for the daring Scarlet Pimpernel. His wave of meditation, however, was here abruptly stemmed by Blakeney's pleasant voice.
"Well, Monsieur Chauvelin," he said, "I fear me your luck has deserted you. Chance, as you see, has turned to me once more."
"Then it is for you, Sir Percy," rejoined the Frenchman, "to name the conditions under which we are to fight."
"Ah, that is so, is it not, monsieur?" quoth Sir Percy lightly. "By my faith, I'll not plague you with formalities. We'll fight with our coats on, if it be cold, in our shirt-sleeves, if it be sultry. I'll not demand either green socks or scarlet ornaments. I'll even try and be serious for the space of 2 minutes, sir, and confine my whole attention, the product of my infinitesimal brain, to thinking out some pleasant detail for this duel, which might be acceptable to you. Thus, sir, the thought of weapons springs to my mind. Swords, you said, I think. Sir, I will e'en restrict my choice of conditions to that of the actual weapons with which we are to fight. Folks, I pray you," he added, turning to his friend, "the pair of swords which lie across the top of my desk at this moment." "We'll not ask a menial to fetch them, eh, monsieur?" he continued gaily, as Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, at a sign from him, had quickly left the room. "What need to bruit our pleasant quarrel abroad? You will like the weapons, sir, and you shall have your own choice from the pair. You are a fine fencer, I feel sure, and you shall decide if a scratch or two or a more serious wound shall be sufficient to avenge Mademoiselle Candeille's wounded vanity." Whilst he prattled so gaily on, there was dead silence among all those present. The prince had his shrewd eyes steadily fixed upon him, obviously wondering what this seemingly irresponsible adventurer held at the back of his mind. There is no doubt that everyone felt oppressed, and that a strange murmur of anticipatory excitement went round the little room, when a few seconds later Sir Andrew Ffoulkes returned with two sheathed swords in his hand. Blakeney took them from his friend and placed them on the little table in front of ex-ambassador Chauvelin. The spectators strained their necks to look at the two weapons. They were exactly similar one to the other, both encased in plain black leather sheaths, with steel ferrules polished to shine like silver. The handles, too, were of plain steel, with just the grip fashioned in a twisted basket pattern of the same highly tempered metal. "What think you of these weapons, monsieur?" asked Blakeney, who was carelessly leaning against the back of a chair. Chauvelin took up one of the two swords and slowly drew it out from its scabbard, carefully examining the brilliant, narrow steel blade as he did so. "A little old-fashioned in style and make, Sir Percy," he said, closely imitating his opponent's easy demeanour. "A trifle heavier, perhaps, than we in France have been accustomed to lately, but nevertheless a beautifully tempered piece of steel." "Of a truth there's not much the matter with the tempering, monsieur," quoth Blakeney. "The blades were fashioned at Toledo just 200 years ago. "Ah, here I see an inscription," said Chauvelin, holding the sword close to his eyes, the better to see the minute letters engraved in the steel. "The name of the original owner. I myself bought them when I travelled in Italy from one of his descendants." "Lorenzo Giovanni Cenci," said Chauvelin, spelling the Italian names quite slowly. "The greatest blackguard that ever trod this earth. You, no doubt, monsieur, know his history better than we do. Rapine, theft, murder, nothing came amiss to Signor Lorenzo. Neither the deadly drug in the cup, nor the poisoned dagger." He had spoken lightly, carelessly, with that same tone of easy banter which he had not forsaken throughout the evening, and the same drawly manner which was habitual to him. But at these last words of his, Chauvelin gave a visible start, and then abruptly replaced the sword which he had been examining upon the table. He threw a quick, suspicious glance at Blakeney, who, leaning back against the chair and one knee resting on the cushioned seat, was idly toying with the other blade, the exact pair to the one which the ex-ambassador had so suddenly put down. "Well, monsieur," quoth Sir Percy after a slight pause, and meeting with a swift glance of lazy irony his opponent's fixed gaze, "are you satisfied with the weapons? Which of the two shall be yours, and which mine?" "Of a truth, Sir Percy," murmured Chauvelin, still hesitating. "Nay, monsieur," interrupted Blakeney with pleasant bonhomie, "I know what you would say. Of a truth, there is no choice between this pair of perfect twins. One is as exquisite as the other. And yet you must take one and I the other, this or that, whichever you prefer. You shall take it home with you tonight, and practice thrusting at a haystack or at a bobbin, as you please. The sword is yours to command until you have used it against my unworthy person, yours until you bring it out 4 days hence on the southern ramparts of Boulogne when the cathedral bells chime the evening angelus. Then you shall cross it against its faithless twin. There, monsieur, they are of equal length, of equal strength and temper, a perfect pair. Yet I pray you choose." He took up both the swords in his hands, and carefully balancing them by the extreme tip of their steel-bound scabbards, he held them out towards the Frenchman. Chauvelin's eyes were fixed upon him, and he, from his towering height, was looking down at the little sable-clad figure before him. The terrorist seemed uncertain what to do. Though he was one of those men whom by the force of their intellect, the strength of their enthusiasm, the power of their cruelty had built a new anarchical France, had overturned a throne and murdered a king, yet now, face to face with this affected fop,
this lazy and debonair adventurer, he hesitated, trying in vain to read what was going on behind that low, smooth forehead, or within the depth of those lazy blue eyes. He would have given several years of his life at this moment for one short glimpse into the innermost brain cells of this daring mind, to see the man start, quiver but for the fraction of a second, betray himself by a tremor of the eyelid. What counterplan was lurking in Percy Blakeney's head as he offered to his opponent the two swords which had once belonged to Lorenzo Cenci? Did any thought of foul play, of dark and deadly poisonings, linger in the fastidious mind of this accomplished gentleman? Surely not. Chauvelin tried to chide himself for such fears. It seemed madness even to think of Italian poisons, of the Cencis or the Borgias, in the midst of this brilliantly lighted English drawing-room. But because he was above all a diplomatist, a fencer with words and with looks, the envoy of France determined to know, to probe, and to read. He forced himself once more to careless laughter and nonchalance of manner, and schooled his lips to smile up with gentle irony at the good-humoured face of his arch-enemy. He tapped one of the swords with his long-pointed finger. "Is this the one you choose, sir?" asked Blakeney. "Nay. Which do you advise, Sir Percy?" replied Chauvelin lightly. "Which of these two blades, think you, is most like to hold, after 200 years, the poison of the Cenci?" But Blakeney neither started nor winced. He broke into a laugh, his own usual pleasant laugh, half shy and somewhat inane, then said in tones of lively astonishment, "Zounds, sir, but you are full of surprises. Faith, I never would have thought of that. Marvellous, I call it, demmed marvellous. What say you, gentlemen? Your Royal Highness, what think you? Is not my engaging friend here of a most original turn of mind? Will you have this sword or that, monsieur? Nay, I must insist, else we shall weary our friends if we hesitate too long. This one, then, sir, since you have chosen it," he continued, as Chauvelin finally took one of the swords in his hand. "And now for a bowl of punch. Nay, monsieur, was demmed smart what you said just now. I must insist on your joining us in a bowl. Such wit as yours, monsieur, must need wetting at times. I pray you repeat that same sally again." Then, finally turning to the prince and to his friends, he added, "And after that bowl, gentlemen, shall we rejoin the ladies?" End of chapter 12.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.